His name's Ross Fletcher, and he's next.
And now, from the legendary Studio B, so you're in Seattle with Gregor.
Now, I'm not sure if Ross remembers this, but the first time he showed up at the station to record a segment on air with me, I was super excited, super nervous. I've never met a professional sports commentator before, and here he was going to be in person. I had talked to a few, but never, like, actually seen one as a human. They're not robots, it turns out. I remember being like, okay, well, thanks, maybe we could, like, do this again, or, And Ross seemed super confused by the thing that had gone really well. But my lack of confidence, like, sold me short. He gave me some sort of, like, okay, well, I'd like to. I enjoyed myself, you dummy. So, I felt pretty dumb over this. Over the years, some of the silliest yet professional exchanges I've been part of on the radio were with Ross. We've enjoyed years of partnership in this crazy little radio world, and I was shocked and heartbroken to learn when he would no longer be calling the games that I loved and had grown to know him for. Of course, we used it as an opportunity to be ridiculous, brought out the giant Ross head and goofed off with t-shirts and stuff to make it fun. And all the time that I worked with him, I never really took the time to ask the guy about a wealth of resource, a pro at the top of his field, what does it take to even get there? You see that? I prepared for something for once.
This is ridiculous.
It's like, take a look.
You've got words written down.
Yeah.
You've got elevator music.
It's the best.
You brought water in for me.
I always bring water.
Okay, you always bring water.
The headphones and the water, that's a thing. That's
amazing. A thing. I feel kind of honored that you're giving me this treatment.
Oh, good. That's what I'm going for. I like it. You got the biggest smile on your face right now. It's wonderful.
Well, just because I'm seeing your lovely mustachioed face.
And I don't look like I'm homeless anymore, like the first time you see me at the beginning of the year every year.
Okay.
That's what you say to me every time. I've got, like, shaggy hair, and, like, I haven't shaved my beard in a month, and now this time I'm cleaned up.
You haven't shaved your beard in about 2.5 weeks,
yeah.
And you've got that grade that says, I can't be bothered with my moustache, but I sort of can my beard, and as for my hair, well, let's go for a flop fest.
I love all of this right now. Dude, you just got back from, like, somewhere much colder than here. You must be stoked to be it's freak week in February. My friend, when I moved here, told me that there was always a week in February that it was, like, beautiful, and you'd get, like, oh, this is great, and then be just crapped on for the next 4 months of rain.
Well, we had 4 months of crap rain, but I love that you use the word stoked, because that's about the only adjective I've heard in the last 2.5-3 weeks.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I went to Norway.
Oh, is it Norway?
Norway.
That's Oslo specifically?
Woo, look at you.
Yeah.
I spent 2 days in Oslo, glorious Oslo, and the rest of the time in Lillehammer. Now, for those of you who like your television pop culture,
sure,
you probably know about the show Lillehammer.
No.
Okay. Look it up.
Okay.
Basically, a dodgy guy gets sent to this tiny North Norwegian town of Lillehammer,
yeah,
on some kind of witness protection program. I've never seen the series. Apparently, it's very good. It's an American series. You can probably get it on Netflix.
Is that some weird European thing you watch?
No. There's plenty of that I watch, but this isn't. But I was in Lillehammer,
uh-huh,
for the Youth Winter Olympics.
Cool.
So basically, a bunch of 15 to 18-year-old kids doing death-defying tricks, and they are the next generation of athletes. So I spent a good couple of weeks there, and this was the place 22 years ago where they had the Winter Olympics in 1994.
So you probably weren't privy to this, but there was a, like, David Letterman, back before cable was king, you know, you had, like, your big nighttime television shows, and David Letterman, longtime late night host, sent his mother to Lillehammer to report in for him. That was that was his correspondent there. Hello, David! Every night that he would check in with her, and just a sweet Midwestern woman doing that. And so I have this very vivid memory of nothing more than this little blue-haired woman that was there at the games with her hair matching the color of the snow. It was
fabulous.
Fantastic, so.
Yeah, it's so nice. She probably stayed there, to be honest. They're all very warm and welcoming. Bizarrely, for somewhere that's not American, the only thing they really seem to eat is burgers. They had so many burger outlets. And for some reason, their gas stations had loads of different options of burgers.
Ugh.
So you could go for the Hawaii burger. Or that was an Esso. At Shell, you could go for the Dallas burger.
Hold on, what are the differences here?
I think one of them had bacon on, one didn't.
Okay.
And then I'd drive in every day from this lovely little skiing village called Hafjell to Lillehammer, where our offices were. That we drove past a place. Bear in mind, this is Norway, a very straight European country. a place called dudeburger.no. Check it out online, NO being Norway instead of .com. Dudeburger. And there was never anybody in there. But it seems like this lovely, very cultured European country, at least outside of Oslo, all they ate was flipping burgers.
Why is that? That's crazy.
Yeah, I've got no idea. And so we were looking for some local fare, and their local fare is meatballs called Shekoke. Which was quite nice, actually. They have meatballs in cranberry sauce.
Ooh.
That was quite local. The rest of it was just flipping burgers.
What would you have done if you were like me and doing vegetarian February? I haven't had any meat in a month.
Died.
Oh, man. There's nothing else. Eat the snow or not the yellow
That's
snow.
Quite healthy. Oh, yeah. It's my top tip.
Top tips with Ross Fletcher.
There you go. You've learned a lot already. Yeah, they do vegetables and stuff. It's just a really expensive country.
Oh, really?
Their fruit is quite cheap. I'm getting really off tangent here.
I don't care. I'm fascinated.
But it's one of the wealthiest countries in the world. It's outside the European Union.
Norway?
Yeah, it's within the travel zone, the Schengen travel zone or whatever, so you can go there freely if you're European. But because of oil and a couple of other big industries, everybody is minted. And so their wages are ridiculously high. Oh. And as a result, the cost of living is ridiculously high to match the wages. So if you go there as a tourist, like a pint of beer, like a large beer, was costing about 11, 12 bucks.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
It's like Los Angeles prices.
And like a dude burger would be like 22, 24 bucks. Just like a standard burger with some fries. So I just ate kind of protein bars all 2 weeks that I was there that I brought over from the States.
Who is your employer for that? Does the BBC send you over? Or is
so I worked for the World Feed.
Okay.
A company that basically does the output for everyone. And I guess it's a long and winding story, but I started at the Olympic Games as a reporter with the BBC in 2008 in Beijing, and then my boss from the BBC moved to this other company, and he said, look, can you come with me and be a reporter for me? And they did their first ever World Feed in 2008, and it's grown bigger and bigger and bigger. The idea being that there are so many camera crews in the world from so many TV companies, you can't fit all of their cameras into the same arenas.
Sure.
It's just not physically possible. So what's happened with the Olympics, as it has with Premier League soccer and a lot of other sports around the world, is they have one centralized production, which distributes the at least live coverage to everybody. So one camera crew does the standard production that everyone around the world will take, that NBC will take, that the BBC will take, that the Chinese company CCTV will take. All the rights holders use that feed. So what we were doing in Lillehammer was providing that and a highlights package. So in America, my reports were going out on NBC SN, effectively.
How did I see none of them?
Because you weren't watching NBC SN.
I watch Premier League all the time.
Oh,
I didn't know that. I figured you were doing it for England or something. I didn't realize it was for here.
Doing it for the world.
Oh, my God. That's so crazy. Okay. Yeah. Well, then I have a question, because I know I'll be watching the television. I'll be watching the Arsenal match or something like that, right? And it won't be one of the ones that Arlo and friends are covering, the NBC guys. It'll be something that we're piping in from the World Feed. And there might be a World Feed commentator or something. Or they send a feed with the sounds built into it, right? It's like everything. It's the stadium ambiance. It's the fans cheering, the sound of the ball being kicked. And then if you bring in the commentators over the top of it, that's on a separate feed, and then they just match up?
That's right. So what I do now with my work with Fox Sports in L.A., a lot of that work is off a TV monitor. So it's what you just described there,
sure,
where you will have the game coming into the studio, but just the audio effects of the crowd, etc. You put your own commentary voice on it. Or you can take the other feed, which already has the World Feed commentators.
Yeah.
So if you're watching an NBC game that isn't Arlo White, that's the World Feed. It'll either be a guy like John Champion, Peter Drury.
Great.
There's lots. I'm trying to think of some of the other guys. Jim Proudfoot. La, 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 la. There's lots of those guys. And that will be distributed to all the companies, the TV companies around the world that have bought the rights. So they can just place that into their coverage rather than sending their own commentators to England and their own TV cameras and multiplying the process, when actually one set of cameras will do that for everybody. And then you can add your own voices if you want to.
So right before the match starts, rather than having any pregame commentary that's coming on the World Feed of whatever their World Feed commentators are, they can just switch between ambiance to now the World Feed commentators are included. And so it's
fascinating. There you go. And what will happen is a couple of hours before the game, maybe even earlier than that, The production company, in soccer's case in the Premier League, Premier League Productions, will send out a running order, basically a sheet of instructions to all the broadcasters around the world who are taking this feed, saying at, if it's a 3 o'clock kickoff, at 2:01 p.m., we'll bring you a live shot of the stadium, a wide shot.
Great.
At 2:06, we'll bring you an interview with the home manager. At 2:10, we'll bring you an interview with the away manager. So all those TV companies around the world can build their content in the knowledge of what's actually going to be coming down the line to them. And then they'll say at 2:37, we'll give you warm-up shots. 6 warm-up shots of the home team, 6 warm-up shots of the away team. So again, you can basically bring in those pictures and put them out on your own system, having either edited them or put them out live, knowing what you're going to get. So
do you get like a run sheet then that you're sitting in the studio with? Like if you were doing a soccer match, like you know that like you need to talk until 36 and then from 37 till 40 it'll be a talk with the coach or whatever, that type of thing?
If it was me, no, if I'm doing play-by-play, because I know basically at kickoff time, it's go time for me.
And we're off.
And
yeah.
We're off. There you go. And the producer just says, and mic live. And you go. And at half time, you have to try and sync your timings up to work with your own studio production, if that's the case. So not necessarily for me, but more for the producers who are putting the shows together, whether it's at Fox or at NBC or Star Sports in India or ABC or Sky Sports in Australia, wherever that might be for those guys that run those world feeds or put their own stuff over the top of the world feed.
Okay, so we just started at like one end of it, that like this very advanced, this conceptual thing that we're talking about where you have to be a kind of a pro to make all these pieces work together. But where does this all start for you as a kid? What was your, how did you find yourself being pulled towards broadcasting if you even did?
I don't know, not necessarily a random story. I suppose lots of people have the same kind of inklings that I do, and it 11, 12 maybe, I kind of love the sound of my own voice. Don't we all as broadcasters?
Oh man, I just wanted everyone to know how cool Nirvana was. That was my thing. I want everyone to know how much I love Nirvana.
And what I wanted to do was to let everyone in school assembly know how cool our soccer team was, school 11-a-side soccer team was. And so I would compile match reports, write match reports of our school soccer games, and then read them out in front of everybody at assembly. Bit of a show off, I know.
What? How terrifying.
That's... No, I loved it. I loved it.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, and I thought, oh, this sounds quite like fun. And then when I was 14 and I was growing up listening to local radio on my favourite soccer team,
sure,
listening to the play-by-play.
Nottingham.
And also the new national radio station, as it was then, Radio 5 Live from the BBC. And I used to love listening to their play-by-plays. And I thought, I'd love to do that. I really enjoy the atmosphere and the painting the pictures. And along came a competition on the old BBC Radio 5 Live for budding commentators. And the idea was,
wow,
6 kids would win the chance to go and do play-by-play on the League Cup final in England, which is one of the biggest games of the year. And I thought, I'd love a go at that. So you had to submit, I think it was 5 minutes of play-by-play to the competition, and then on your old C90 cassette recorder and see how you did. I thought this would be great. So I did Leicester City against Nottingham Forest in the old Division 1, I think it was. I was 14.
And that's the two teams nearest to your hometown?
Yeah, two teams nearest to me. They just happened to be on the TV that day, and I knew them because being a fan of one of them. And I did the most squeaky, high-pitched play-by-play. It was just like that.
Stevie
and my mum and dad still have the tape somewhere in their loft. And as embarrassing as it is now, I just want to keep it for posterity because, hey, that's who I was at that time.
Let's put that on YouTube already.
Let's not go that far. Let's keep it for personal consumption.
SoundCloud?
But you're not convincing me here.
How about you send it to me so I can put it on the blog and then we can...
Yeah, I'm stupid, but not quite that
Could you send
that
us like
stupid?
30 seconds? Could you give us 30 seconds of it?
Look, they'll never find it. The amount of clutter in my parents' loft, it's impossible. They've been asking me for decades to get rid of it all. I'm like, no.
Yeah, come on.
When I come back to England, maybe. But either way, I submitted this squeaky voice, Stan Collymore, across to Ian Road. Oh, and the goalkeeper's just got his hands on the ball. And I thought, oh, I haven't got a chance with this. And waited a couple of weeks.
Goalkeeper's got his hands on the ball.
Honestly, it was dynamic. It was absolutely dynamic.
I can't do an impression to save my life, but I think if I just go a high pitch, I can do them then.
Great.
Okay.
Whew. Speed it up, you sound like a chipmunk. And Alvin and the Chipmunks, remember them. And so a couple of weeks later, I got a letter back with something else. And it was a baseball cap for this show called Go that Garth Crooks used to present. He used to play for Tottenham Hotspur and now is a panelist on one of the BBC's big soccer shows. And it was a runners-up baseball cap saying, thank you for your entry. You didn't win, but we really liked it. And even though I didn't get through to commentate at Wembley, which would be every child's dream
buggers.
Who loves soccer, I thought, well, yeah, I'll still keep on going with this. And so from 14 on, loved the idea of it. I would used to turn down the sound on my TV and commentate to myself. Thought, oh, I might be all right at this. So at 16, one of my local radio stations, BBC Radio Derby, my sister was going out with the late night weekend DJ from that station.
Hot.
It's always who you know, not what you know. And I said to him, hey, any chance I can get in on the sports team to see what they do? And luckily Tom, who's now my brother-in-law,
oh,
bless you, Tom, said, okay, I'll have a word with the sports editor, a guy called Colin Gibson. We'll see what we can do. And he came back to me, I don't know, a short time later and said, hey, yeah, Colin said, come on into the studio, 3 Saturdays in a row, sit in the studio itself, watch them press all the buttons, see how the magic happens on the sports show, which ran from 2 till 6 on a Saturday during the Derby County game, and, you know, see if you like it. So no promises beyond those 3 weeks. And basically, I never left.
That's incredible. That's how it goes, though, in this business. People don't realize that's what it is. You just get your foot in and then you just keep showing up.
Yeah, so 12, 14 years later, I finally left that place, having done a multitude of jobs and interviewed some incredible people. And so from 16, they then said after these 3 weeks, look, do you want to stay on for the summer when we just do our afternoon mess about programming? It's just kind of, we'll take the radio car out to local fetes, interview people about their bird shows and, you know, all these random things. You can sit there and answer the competition phone lines. In those days, competitions were big, where at least, kind of, you know, 30, 40 people would phone up wanting to win a CD of an artist you'd never heard of. I said, yeah, I'd love to. So for a couple of months, sat there on a Saturday, got the train up every day from my hometown of Loughborough and worked unpaid. And that carried on for, I think, about 2 years. I did 2 years of Saturdays unpaid. I'd go in every holiday they asked me to when nobody wanted to work to show willing and show that I was keen and give me the opportunity to do things. And at 17, maybe, I started reading out the soccer results from the ultra-local soccer leagues. So bear in mind, the show finished at 6 p.m. At 5 minutes to 6, I'd have a gigantic couple of sheets with the local, hyper-local results. So bear in mind, the top division, the Barclays Premier League, Manchester United 1, Chelsea 0. And then me, it was my favourite one, sponsored to the hilt, and they probably paid him £100 just to sponsor this league for the whole year. The Redferns International Removers, Central Midlands Football League, Travis Perkins, Supreme Division. Bledworth Colliery against Rolls-Royce 9th team, match postponed, waterlogged pitch. So, I mean, that was just a great introduction to broadcasting. They were my first broadcast. And there I was holding a sheet of paper, just trembling as I read into this microphone. I remember after doing a couple of them, my boss Colin said, look, you can inject a bit of personality, but I was just trying to play it straight to be the guy that didn't make a mistake.
Yeah.
And, you know, from there, it carried on. I went to college about an hour north in
but
Sheffield.
Hold on, that whole idea that you play it straight and that you don't give up too much is something that you're kind of known for. It's like such a huge professional quality that you have when things aren't going your way or when someone asks you something dodgy, as you would say. You don't blink to anything like that. You can be so pro about that. Is it something you learned just from trying to get onto the radio or like...
I think you just, through osmosis, through listening to people, watching other people, and the BBC, they probably still do, but at my time, had the most fantastic training programme. And again, I tip my hat to my old editor, Mike Betterson, who showed incredible amounts of faith in me. At 18, I started doing proper broadcasting on their morning sports shows, or their morning breakfast show doing the sports bulletins. Saturday lunchtime, I'd do sports bulletins in
radio.
The morning as well on the radio. At 19, having just started to make my way as a very, you know, high-pitched Saturday broadcaster, they sent me on a week-long training course to be a BBC presenter. At 19, That must have cost them an awful lot. It was a residency programme in the southwest of the country, in a city called Bristol. And I was the youngest guy there by about 15 years, and there was only 7 or 8 of us, and we spent a whole week learning the essential tips of the trade to be a radio broadcaster. Not a sports broadcaster, but just a radio broadcaster. And that was invaluable for me. And I remember that one of the first tasks they made me do in front of everybody, they had studios rather like we're sitting in now, where you have one studio, lots of buttons and screens with the microphones, and facing it was an identical studio. We all sat, all 7 or 8 of us, in one studio, and one by one, we were made by the instructor to walk around, open the door, open the other door to the other studio, close the door, and sit solemnly facing everybody else in the opposite studio, open the microphone so everyone else could hear, and the instruction was, talk about yourself for 5 minutes.
Oh my goodness.
As a 19-year-old, and you've got to remember, this is my own opinion, but I think Americans are much more loquacious. They're much more talkative and much more confident in front of a microphone than Brits are. It's maybe some of the self-deprecating nature of British people, and whether you're taught to be more confident and stand up in school in America, I don't know. But for a 19-year-old kid learning his way to then sit in a studio opposite a lot of other people who are a lot older and a lot more experienced than me, to talk about myself for 5 minutes was the most daunting thing in the world. And I remember sitting there and I opened the mic, getting a little bit trembly, and said, "Oh, hi, yeah, my name's Ross Fletcher. I'm from Loughborough, Leicestershire. I love sports. I've got mum and dad and an older brother and an older sister. And at the moment, I'm working part-time at BBC Radio Derby." Look up at the clock.
That was 14 seconds.
Yeah, exactly. No more than that. Thinking, what do I do now? But I tell you, that week was one of the most instructive of my broadcasting life and really gave me the groundwork to go on and be, in inverted commas, successful. And so I started presenting my first show on the BBC at 19, the Saturday lunchtime show, which was a mess-around show, which was the prelude to the serious sports show. I play a few tunes, and I got free rein again from the editor to do what I wanted. I mean, we were giving away terrible prizes, like a ridiculous CD and a banana, for playing with the audience on the phone line radio darts. So I brought in a plastic dartboard with felt darts, and I got the newsreader and the phone answerer to come in, and they play against each other, blindfolded effectively, and a caller would be assigned to the team member, and they would have to tell them, on the radio, remember,
sure,
left a bit, up a bit, fire! And then the other person on the other line would tell their newsreader, okay, down, 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 forward, fire! And throw darts on the radio at a dartboard. And honestly, we didn't mock it up. These are just the random things you do as a student on the BBC radio network.
You don't know any better, right?
Exactly. I used to get the main broadcaster and commentator of the day for the Derby County show on 15 minutes before their programme. And instead of talking soccer, we just do a 1970s music challenge where I play a load of old tunes from Motown or whatever in the 60s or 70s and get them to beat each other on Beat the Intro to the song, and people just seem to lap it up as listeners. And that was just really good fun for me, just starting out as this fresh-faced kid.
Well, you're creating story. You're giving these people character.
Yeah.
The people that they're about to listen to drone on about sports, which are fascinating if you're into sports. You're giving them character. That's something you told me about. Commentating soccer is not about saying necessarily what's happening play-by-play, especially on TV. It's about telling a story that's going on.
Yeah, the best people are the storytellers. They really are. They bring the page to life.
Where did you learn that?
Again, through experience, working at the BBC, getting that training, watching other broadcasters, listening to other broadcasters, talking to other broadcasters, and then finding your own favourites and scribbling down notes that you thought were good when you heard something that you really liked.
Well, that week-long training you go to for the BBC, I figured for sure it'd be 6 months, a year, something like that. I'm shocked that it's only a week.
Well, it was only a week, but then it was continuous. You were always getting feedback in your environment at the radio station, and then they would top it up with other days, and I'll get on to being a soccer play-by-play guy, where I also had residency courses. So it wasn't like that was it. That was the beginning. That was my foundation. and on you go from that intensive experience.
Now, is that something only available to British people?
No, I don't think so, but the BBC is world-renowned as being the world's leading radio broadcaster in both news and... Again,
second behind 107.7 The End,
well, exactly,
obviously.
Yeah. And has an incredible sports reputation. So that cachet is there. And for any aspiring broadcaster, something the BBC does, which I think is wonderful, has an online training academy where basically most, if not all, of its training resources are out there for anybody to access. In the commercial world, that kind of knowledge and info will be worth tens of hundreds of thousands of dollars.
However, it's something that you addressed very early on. It's that people, that information is available, but it's the people that find it and run with it. You have to have that hunger and that willingness to go after it in order to turn it into something. Otherwise, it's just unused knowledge.
Well, exactly. And that's why I hammered away, worked unpaid for 2 years. The next 2 years, I'd working for Buttons, basically to cover my train fare or my gas money and my lunch money, just to make it. And you have to put that time in, that commitment, show willingness, make everybody a cup of coffee if they need it, and do whatever. Work on the holidays. Like I say, the day after Christmas Day is a huge day in the UK called Boxing Day, where everyone has the day off. But it's the biggest day on the soccer calendar in the UK. And every year they'd say, can you come in and work it? We need you. No money. I said, well, yeah. You know, I was missing my family time, but thought, if I'm going to make it in this business, I've got to show willing. So I did. And then that put me in the position where at 19, I filled in for a few shows. Then at 20, in the January, when I was 20 years old, they gave me that show permanently. That was my own show.
Cool.
So I was a permanent fixture on a BBC radio station at 20, which is... very, very young. And I feel like I was a little bit fortunate, but also I darn well earned my position there. I did the groundwork. And then as luck would have it, I was all the time at college working or studying economics at the University of Sheffield.
At the same time.
But I was never a big fan of economics. I kind of liked it. I'm still interested in it to this day.
I've been to a lecture about it with you, so I'd say you're still into it.
Yeah. Read The Economist and like to see financial articles now and again. A bit geeky like that. But my passion was always sport and sports broadcasting. And I thought, because I knew before I went to university, I was already on this path of being a sports broadcaster, so I could do that on the side, but also do a... quote, proper degree, so if sports broadcasting didn't work out, I would have something to fall back on that would allow me to go into the proper, again, inverted commas, world of work. And so I remember in June 2000, my final exam as a student, advanced econometrics in the Goodwin Sports Hall at University of Sheffield, 9 till midday, did not have a Scooby-Doo what I was doing in this paper, not a clue. Wrote a few answers down, but I knew at 2 p.m. that day I had an interview for a full-time sports broadcaster's position at the radio station I was working, BBC Radio Derby. And that was the big focus of the day, naturally, because as luck would have it, one of the only two sports broadcasters at the station was leaving. So this job came up. Of course, I was in the right place at the right time, applied for it, had the interview. So at 9 till 12, I did this exam. Midday... got into my old Peugeot 205 look, this tiny rattly little French car, 4-gear speed, still managed to do 90 miles an hour down the A38, the road that links Sheffield and Derby. I can't remember how it did that, even sometimes at 4:30 in the morning on a Wednesday morning when I was going to do some broadcasting. And in those days, as a tangent, I get up at 4:30 in the morning on a Wednesday morning from university, having not gone out the night before, obviously.
Obviously.
Arrive at 5:30 in the morning at the radio station, do a sports broadcasting shift from 6 till 9 in the breakfast show, reading out the sports news, drive back 9 till 10, go into my lectures 10 till 1, fall asleep in my 12 o'clock lecture, and then repeat the process a couple of days later. But I did this exam, final exam, 9 till midday, drove down to Derby, got there about 1 o'clock, interview at 2 for the sports broadcaster's full-time job, drove home to my parents' house. At 5 o'clock, got a ring from the editor, Mike Betterson. Congratulations, you've got the job. So on the day of my final exam at university, I became a full-time BBC sports broadcaster, which was just, for me, fantastic.
Did you pass the test? The exam?
Barely.
So you even got a degree out of it. That's amazing.
Got a degree in economics from a top 10 UK university. And managed to get my first job as a sports broadcaster. And I remember saying to them at the time, look, can I have a few months off? I just want to enjoy my last summer before the real world comes upon me. And the boss went, nope, you're starting in 2 weeks' time. I said, okay.
And grab your backpack and go around as fast as you can.
There you go. So I had a couple of weeks off and then bang, straight into it, into the new soccer season. And took it from there.
Okay, I guess maybe it's not clear because we don't have a system like it, but like the BBC has a hub in all the major cities in England, correct?
Yeah.
And then they all, do you cover like a main feed that comes from London ever, or is it each one has its own individual aspect?
Each one has its own identity. Like in Seattle, there are radio stations that have their own programming.
Yeah.
At midnight, maybe, you'll then go to the national broadcaster till 5 a.m. Yeah. or whatever it is, and then you'll pick up local broadcasting. So when I was there from 5 in the morning till midnight, there was local programming on all 40 of these local radio stations.
Are there other stations, other private stations that are there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there are plenty of commercial stations.
Yeah.
So the BBC is a many-tentacled beast. It has this network, this fabulous network of local radio stations and an audience of about 8 million listeners a week, I think, now combined. And then it has lots of national stations catering to different tastes. So BBC Radio 1 is the youth music station, 10 million listeners a week. Fabulous record since it started in the 60s. BBC Radio 2 is the behemoth, which is the all-encompassing popular music station, should I say. 15 million listeners a week, and I was lucky to broadcast some sport on there.
Cool.
Radio 3, the classical music station, 2 million listeners a week, very niche. But again, the BBC is about providing for everybody. It's a public service broadcaster.
Right.
Radio 4, the very serious, heavy-hitting intellectual station, again, did a few broadcasts on there regarding sport. 10, 11 million listeners a week, and that's known for getting the big political stories of the day. And then BBC Radio 5 Live, which is where I eventually worked, which is the rolling news and sports station for, again, the country, 6, 7 million listeners a week. And I spent a good 5.5, 6 years there as a freelance guy, sports broadcasting on their bulletins, doing soccer play-by-play, soccer reporting. And then you've got other stations, digital-only stations. And then you've got the commercial stations where they play popular music and they're always struggling against the might of the BBC.
Oh, it's crazy. It's because like the exact opposite.
Yeah, I mean, 92% of the audience or the population in the UK listens to radio. It's very much driven by radio. TV's massive, of course, but radio is incredibly strong in the UK, and the BBC has a really firm and justifiable hold on that audience. Commercial radio is always battling. Maybe about 46% of the audience listens to commercial stations, which is pop music or not much speech, basically, but they're always trying to battle for their share of the market in the UK.
Oh, man, that's fantastic. It's like, it's fast. When you say BBC 5, like when you go to punch that on your radio, like that's, I only know frequencies. Like I need 2 digits, a decimal, and then another digit so I can find stuff or whatever. I don't understand how that would even work. I would love to see that.
Yeah, it's on medium wave on AM, so 909-693 in the UK. But of course, nowadays, everything's digital, and the big push is to listen on your mobile phone, on your tablet, online, whatever.
They do a great job, man.
Yeah, rather than
blocking
listening
me
on
from
AM.
Getting their content for free. Jerks. Okay, so how do you make that transition then from a sports reporter or a guy that hosts a show or a variety show or a mix around, I think is what you called it, or a mix-up show? Is that what you said?
I don't know.
You said something like that about
it. Oh, yeah.
How do you go from doing that to doing the thing that you wanted to do as a kid that you submitted cassettes for of the play-by-play commentating?
This was, again, it's serendipity, but in an unfortunate way that at 22, I was the sideline reporter for Derby County matches in the Premier League and the league below the Championship, depending on how well or badly they were doing at the time.
Yeah.
And the actual play-by-play guy was a guy called Graham Richards. Wonderful, deep, rasping voice with an incredible turn of phrase. And Monday to Friday, his job was a stipendiary magistrate, basically a judge on the local circuit, doling out porridge to people who'd done misdemeanors. On a Saturday, he was just this evocative, wonderfully voiced play-by-play commentator who'd been doing it for 26 years for Derby County. So he wasn't going anywhere. But in the last few years when I just joined, he was starting maybe to show his age a little bit. Maybe wasn't enjoying it quite as much as he was. And I was filling in for him, doing a few games at 22, which again was freakishly young.
I'm Ross Fletcher!
In the UK world, my voice had got slightly, only slightly
I'm
deeper
Ross Fletcher.
Since then. And This is a really sad story because I wouldn't have wanted to move into the role I did the way I did, but it just happened like this. That Graham, on the first anniversary of the falling of the Twin Towers, made an unfortunate remark about that, tying it into a soccer play-by-play broadcast. He was trying to use imagery, but it badly backfired. And on that anniversary, a lot of people, quite rightly, were sensitive to the remarks he made, and that caused a big storm. It went national and international. The comments that he made while on air made the Sydney Morning Herald the next morning. And from then on, he was should we say, gently leveraged out of that role, and I took over. So there was this guy in his 60s who had done incredible service, moving out of the role in unfortunate circumstances, making way for a guy probably three times younger than him with a totally different style. But this was my opportunity. And this was my chance to be a play-by-play guy in one of the highest-rated local broadcasts in the country on a very good team.
Were you grateful that there was no internet at the time to tell you how great of a job you were doing?
Well, exactly.
Sarcasm.
Because, yeah, you know what it's like nowadays. It's a brutal world out there. Everybody has an opinion, and a lot of people are willing to share it, and often more negative than positive.
Sure.
And so it took me a long while to actually grow into that role, but what an opportunity for me. And at the same time, I took over the Drive Time show Monday to Friday, doing the news and sport of the day from 4 till 7. And it was all speech back in those days, from 4 till 6. So 2 hours of solid news broadcasting, which really shaped me as a broadcaster. And the first things I did was to reflect the news of the second Iraq war, talking to correspondents on the ground, interviewing them, finding out what's going on. And that really sharpened my tools as a journalist, not just as a sports broadcaster. And then, you know, had the fortune to interview British prime ministers a few times, grilling them on the issues of the day when it came to election time, and lots of many and varied stories, well, Monday to Friday.
Well, the BBC, the British press is not known as being kind or respectful towards the authority. Like,
holds them to account in a way I don't think anyone else does around the world.
Which is, must be, the pressure for them must be even more insane. But as a journalist, to be able to speak your mind then has to be refreshing as well.
Well, in a way, I wasn't speaking my mind, because you're mindful of the BBC's editorial standards that you almost don't have an opinion. You have to let the opinion makers voice that, and it's your job as a journalist to get those opinions out of them and to be fair, to be unbiased, and to uphold those standards, those integral standards. So that was, again, a real learning tool for me.
How surprised are you when you come here and you see the way that the journalism is conducted with nothing but bias, it feels like?
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough because I want the news. I don't want your opinion of the news. Just give me the facts and I'll make my own mind up. And that's the way I broadcast and was brought up to broadcast, in an unbiased news organisation, of which sadly there are very few remaining. And it's difficult for me because then you have to clear through the clutter of that broadcaster's opinion of the news. I'm not tuning in to hear what you think. I'm tuning in to hear what's happening, and then I'll make my own mind up. I don't need you to make my mind up for me. I don't want my prejudice is being reinforced. I want to be open to what's going on.
Oh.
And then that might alter my prejudice or my view based on facts rather than based on opinions of seeming facts. So that's quite tricky for me to listen to that. Sometimes it's difficult. It's occasionally unpalatable. Yeah, and I think you see it now with the primaries.
Yeah,
you get very skewed news, either left or right. And I think there's very, again, let's not go too deep into it. One of the sadnesses of Al Jazeera America shutting down. I wasn't a consumer of Al Jazeera America, but I lauded the principle that they would try and tell the news as it was and leave you to make your own mind up.
Yeah, I have some thoughts on that as well. Off air for you. So I guess I never I know what you did here in Seattle as a broadcaster, as you got paid to be the Sounders announcer, but there you were doing Derby County games on the weekends, but then also you had a role during the week to uphold journalism and do sports of all different types, I guess. I never really understood that it wasn't just a one thing that you did, that you had to be able to contribute even more.
No, you really had to be an all-rounder, particularly at your local radio station, where there probably wasn't enough staff to be singles specialist, or a couple of specialists maybe, but my role was broader than that. I was a sports specialist, but also could broadcast news, and that really gave me
Did your economics help you with that?
Yeah, I think so. Your rationalization of things, your ability to understand both sides of it and know to what degree that would be of benefit, but the trade-off in the other side of things. So that helped, and it helped your understanding of the business world too when I'm doing business stories. So that was really, really unique for me. And I did that for probably 7-8 years alongside doing the play-by-play. And then it probably 3 years into that, 4 years into that, got noticed by the national radio station, BBC Radio 5 Live, again through doing a workshop, brought a couple of days, go away, a Five Live commentator and a moderator took a group of 8 or 10 of us, of the brightest minds in BBC Radio, local radio commentary, and gave us some commentary feedback. And after that, they said, hey, we like you. Do you want to come and join us on a freelance basis and do broadcasting with us when your commitments allow? So then for a good 5-6 years, working already 6 days a week for the local radio station, if either they had a day off or there was a Sunday game that Five Live, the national station, needed for me, I'd go and work 7 days a week quite often. But I loved it to try and build my career up.
Of course.
So I would mix my Monday to Friday news and sport presenting with Derby County commentary and then national reporting on Five Live and then doing a bit of commentary for them, play-by-play, on some national games. So I did that for 5 or 6 years, melding that into my local radio work. And then eventually the lure of TV comes calling. It's a natural progression. You go from radio into TV. So join the...
Oh, you got to have that mug to be able to do it, though. Hey! That's the thing. Not everyone can just hop on the television, I think.
You have to shave every day as well. That's a real pain. So then I did probably 3 years or so, 3-4 years maybe, on the regional TV network, which is equivalent to King 5 here or Como or whatever, as a sports broadcaster, doing feature stories and soccer reporting, as well as carrying on my national radio at the weekend and the occasional Tuesday and Wednesday match. And then the 2 years prior to being in Seattle, went fully freelance and did more, again, Five Live radio stuff, regional TV, and then some national TV, working for the BBC's international channel, BBC World, doing some sports broadcasting with them. So you might have seen me previously, if you ever flicked on BBC World and on Comcast in Seattle and seen a guy reading the sport, you would never have known, of course, that I'd end up in Seattle. But yeah, that was the 2 years prior to coming here. So I feel like I had a really good radio base and then the TV base, and without to bore you too much, obviously in 2008, as we said at the start of this, began reporting on Olympics.
Yeah.
And having done 2008 in Beijing in the Summer Olympics, I've now done 7 games in total, 2 summer, 2 winter, and 3 youth Olympics.
And with another one coming up this summer in Brazil, you're going to go?
Yeah, I am down and ready for Rio, Zika virus and all.
There's no vaccination against it, so don't be smooching any mosquitoes. You got it?
Yeah. I thought you were going to say something else when you were talking about smooching then, but yeah, I don't think I'll be cuddling up to any of those horrid little mosquitoes.
How do you get the call up to come to Seattle? How does your phone ring for that? I mean, you're a guy that's doing it in England, but like Seattle's far away.
It's a long way away.
Yeah.
This story goes back to 2010 and the Vancouver Winter Olympics.
Oh,
and
that's right. Yeah.
Working up there, doing the freestyle reporting. So half pipe for snowboard and the ski cross, border cross, all those cool kids events and having a great time. And I love Vancouver.
Oh,
basically, I was there for 4 or 5 weeks, lived on the North Shore, saw a load of Vancouver and loved it. Loved it. And this was about the time that Arlo White started broadcasting Sounders games. And our story goes back, and I've told it many times since coming to Seattle, so I'll praise it, that I helped him in a roundabout way get his first gig in radio. He came to BBC Radio Derby as a 25, 26-year-old, hating his current job, and said, look, to Colin Gibson, my then boss, can you give me a chance? And like he did with me, Colin gave Arlo a chance and I helped support him. And when Arlo wanted to move on, he didn't have a demo tape to give to any prospective employers. And after one local game that he came back reporting from, he stood outside the studio after we'd gone off air. I pretended to be the on-air presenter, cued him into his reports. I compiled his demo tape for him, and then he used that to go and get his job in national radio.
Cute.
And so we were buddies, and we stayed buddies, and we always stay buddies. And I love Vancouver. And I said at the time, hey, if Vancouver have a job going, I'd love to do that. And that never came to be. as they use a different kind of a broadcast system. But I said to Arlo, if anything comes up in the area, I'd love to hear about it. He says, okay. And then after 2 years of being a great success in Seattle, Arlo gets poached by the national broadcaster NBC to do their MLS coverage. And Seattle said to Arlo, well, if you leave, can you recommend a replacement? And so at the time, it was the Seahawks and Sounders who were co-running.
You had the might of the NFL kind of as part of the...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it was the Seahawks guys, the Seahawks broadcasting department, who hired Arlo. The Sounders guys didn't have anything to do with it at the time. And likewise, it was the Seahawks guys who were recommended me through Arlo, who came to me, Brian O'Connell, Matt Johnson, and Dave Pearson at the time. And they came to me and said, look, we've been recommended you. Can you send us a demo tape? And there were a couple of other people in the frame, naturally. But apparently I was the front runner on Arlo's recommendation. They liked my demo tape. They flew me over in December 2011, looked around, was absolutely wooed. Of course, the Seahawks know how to do things first class.
Of course.
Flew me over, put me up, went out, saw the Christmas Snowflake Alley, Snowflake Lane Parade in Bellevue when I first landed. And it was my body clock, something like 4 a.m. And there I am, walking down the street in Bellevue with fake snow twirling on my head as these little dressed-up drummers were drumming away. And I'm thinking, where am I?
Good old Snowflake Lane. That's
it was,
what it is.
Yeah, it was a psychedelic experience. It was really weird. But the Seahawks guys really blew my socks off. And came away, bit of a negotiation, talked to my wife, didn't have kids at the time, loved travel, both of us, and thought, if not now, when?
Yeah.
And I guess the rest is history.
That's so crazy to get the opportunity. I guess I don't understand how it would feel to, like, that day when you get onto the plane with only the two bags you can bring or whatever, and be like, oh!
Two suitcases, one backpack, new life.
Did you find the Seattle freeze here? Were people nice to you, or did you find a hard time getting on with people?
I was lucky, because I already had Arlo's network to lean on. And yeah, you come here halfway around the world, 4,500 miles from home, and my wife had stayed in the UK to finish up some work. She was doing a big job on the Olympic torch relay ahead of the London 2012 Olympic Games, so she couldn't put that down, and she did a fantastic job of that. So I was here for 6 months on my own.
Ross didn't wear pants for 6 months.
There was only ever, I think, four items in my fridge at any one time. Because basically I made it my job to go out there, meet people, have lots and lots of dinners, and screw the calorie count.
Yeah.
And got introduced to a few people. And one of the first guys I ever met is one of my best buddies to this day, a guy called Andy. Lovely guy. Shout out to Andy.
What's up, Andy?
And yeah, I would be out 4 days a week, having dinner with different people, building up my network of friends, learning the city. And I've got those friends to really thank for that. Helped me fall in love with this city. And then my wife came in the September of 2012. And here we are, 2016, and we're still here.
Yeah, what
American child, one American child later.
Anchor baby. Yes. You never have to leave, right? That's the
well,
beauty of it.
Well, yeah.
What made you decide that when you're done with the Sounders, what made you decide that you're going to stay in Seattle and try and work remotely rather than moving on to another thing?
A lot of different factors. The people.
Yeah.
The city. We love the lifestyle here. But a lot of it, like anything, is about people. It's about feeling comfortable where you are, not only comfortable in your own skin, but comfortable with the people around you. And we've built up a fantastic network of people. And we're so lucky, so fortunate to have found those people. Naturally, you miss your family, and they're a long way away. Skype and FaceTime are only mitigating factors. But mother-in-law came over for 2 months last year in the summer, had a great time, and helped look after our daughter. And, you know, that's not going to replace the week-to-week contact that you crave. But at the same time, when you feel settled somewhere, I think a lot of people will relate to this, it's difficult to actually want to have to move. And America is a great land of opportunity. And on knowing back in September that will be my last season with the Sounders, very quickly moved to go to other places and find other avenues. And obviously Fox Sports are very good and say, yeah, we'd like to use you, and go back to a national platform, broadcasting platform, which was always the aim for me at some point. And to do that has been really cool. And to continue with my Olympics work, as you mentioned, being in Norway in the last couple of weeks and going to Rio for a month or more in the summer will be terrific. And to look after my child on a kind of a weekly or daily basis is also a real, real kind of thrill.
Good old daddy daycare.
Yeah, that's it. So there will be a day when we go back to the UK, because I think family will be the eventual pull, and maybe other opportunities will be the pull back there. But for now, it's just a great city to live in. And a lot of that is down to the people. And I think a lot of that is down to the warmth of the Sounders community.
They really grabbed onto you, man.
Arlo said this to me a while back. About there was an outpouring of emotion, I think, when I announced I was leaving the Sounders, that he said, look, Sounders fans get very attached. And he was absolutely right. They're still very attached to Arlo some 4 years on. And I think it's so nice to say that a certain section of Sounders fans are still quite attached to me, which is lovely. Again, sense of community. You're not there to hang on to those well wishes, but it makes you feel wanted in a place. It makes you feel like you are at home. And that is again, one of those nice things about being in Seattle.
Thanks for coming, dude.
Good to see you.
You've been listening to So You're in Seattle with Gregor. Follow him on Twitter at Gregor1077 and find more episodes online at 1077theend.com. So You're in Seattle is a Burrito Butt production.
Yeah, you're a good dog, Chowder.